Good morning. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Over 20 million adults in the U.S. suffer from either depression or bipolar disorder. Yet nearly half don't receive any treatment for their condition, and still others are misdiagnosed. What keeps people from getting help, and what do patients need to know when they finally do decide to go and consult a health expert? These are among the questions Dr. William Marchand tackles in a new book, and today on the program, he joins us to talk about what we're learning from neurobiology, how the mind and moods are related, and treatment options that work. And Dr. Marchand joins me in studio. Dr. Marchand, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. William Marchand is a board-certified academic psychiatrist and a neuroscientist. He's currently associate professor of psychiatry and an adjunct professor of psychology at the University of Utah, and his new book is titled Depression and Bipolar Disorder, Your Guide to Recovery. And if you'd like to join us, you're welcome to. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Later on in the program, we're turning to new data that shows an uptick in military suicides. But first, managing depression and bipolar disorder. If you've experienced a mood disorder, how long did it take you to seek help? And what works for you when it comes to managing your depression? You can join us again at 801-355-TALK. Dr. Marchand, you're an academic psychiatrist. You teach, you research, you do clinical work. So why did you decide to write a book for patients, for those who are struggling with mood disorders?
Well, in my years of practice, I've seen so many cases of people who either didn't seek treatment in time or weren't receiving adequate treatment for maybe even years. And also, many people have difficulty negotiating the complex healthcare system. So for all those reasons, I felt like there was a need for sort of a missing manual for recovery from mood disorders. Mm.
There are shelves full of self-help books, you know, ways to deal with depression and mood disorders. How is your book different?
Well, many of those books are very helpful for people, but they're often guiding people to use a specific strategy, which is great. My book aims more broadly to help people determine whether they need help. It also guides them to find help, tells what different providers do, and then it just provides a lot of information about the disorders and the various treatment options and the pros and cons of the different options. It includes a number of complementary strategies, particularly mindfulness meditation. So it's meant to be a comprehensive guide, and it's not to take the place of the other books out there. It more complements many of the others that are available.
As both a clinician and as an academic, I'm curious, what got you interested in depression and in studying mood disorders as an expert?
That's a great question. For one thing, the mood disorders are some of the most common conditions that we treat as psychiatrists, and particularly depression is one of the most common psychiatric disorders that people experience. And so I really felt that there was a need to both study and help people get treatment for these disorders that are so common.
Mm. Why lump depression and bipolar disorder into a single book? I mean, for the non-expert like me, they seem fairly different. So I guess my question is, how are these two conditions different and how are they similar?
Right. That's a great question. The reason I put them in the book is because there's a high risk of bipolar disorder being misdiagnosed as major depression. So, as you may know, major depression is a disorder where people experience episodes of being sad, down, blue. Bipolar disorder, they also experience those episodes, but they also have periods of time where their mood is excessively elevated. That's called mania or hypomania for less severe episodes. The problem is that when a person has a first episode of depression, we currently don't really have a way to know whether it's depression or bipolar disorder. And so we can have some hints, for example, a family history of bipolar disorder, but we don't know for sure. And many people who have milder bipolar disorder called bipolar 2 or cyclothymia, don't really realize sometimes that the upswings are abnormal, and often those don't come out in interviews with healthcare providers. So what happens is those people may be misdiagnosed as major depression, and then they're treated with antidepressants, which aren't recommended alone for bipolar disorder, and their condition ends up getting worse. So I felt like a book that addressed both disorders might help prevent that misdiagnosis that seems to be fairly common according to the studies. Mm.
You write that a majority of people with depression and bipolar disorder don't seek professional help. Why?
Yes, that's a great question too. And, you know, we don't completely understand that. Some of it has to do with stigma. Unfortunately, there's still a lot of stigma out there about having a psychiatric disorder or mental illness. So that's part of it. And sometimes people simply don't recognize that it's a disorder. If someone has been depressed for a long time, it may almost seem like normal to them. Or they may go to their primary care physician and there could be a miscommunication about the symptoms. And so it just isn't diagnosed, even though the person does talk about some of the symptoms they're experiencing. So it seems like there's a wide variety of reasons. Some people may feel like it's a weakness to seek treatment. That might be more prevalent among men. So there seem to be a whole variety of reasons that keep people from getting help.
Mm. Speaking with Dr. William Marchand, he's a board-certified academic psychiatrist and a neuroscientist at the University of Utah. His new book is titled Depression and Bipolar Disorder, Your Guide to Recovery. And if you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Dr. Marchand, as I mentioned, you're a neuroscientist. So what causes these mood and anxiety disorders? What is physically going on in our brains, chemically or physically?
We still don't understand the causes completely. About 40 years ago, the neurotransmitter hypothesis was developed. And so the thinking for many years has been that these disorders are caused by abnormalities in the various neurotransmitters in the brain. And neurotransmitters are chemicals that carry the information from one neuron to the other. They're released at one neuron and cross a little gap called the synapse and then cause the other neuron to fire or activate in some way. So for many years, we thought that particularly depression was in some way a deficit of neurotransmitters such as serotonin. More recently, it appears that it's more complicated than that. There's evidence that some episodes of depression are associated with inflammation in the brain, so that may be a cause in some cases. It certainly does involve neurotransmitters. It may involve dysfunction in the white matter that connects different areas of the brain in some cases. There's evidence that some of the structures in the brain are not functioning correctly, such as the striatum. So most likely depression is not a disorder, but rather a set of symptoms that comes from a variety of biological factors. There's also a strong genetic risk, so there is an inherited risk that people have. The other thing to be aware of, although we talk about psychology and biology as being different, they're probably two sides of the same coin, but nonetheless, there are psychological factors that contribute to depression as well. We all have behaviors and habits that may not be in our best interest, and so some of those can contribute. So the optimal treatment for many people is both a biological intervention, such as an antidepressant for major depression, and a psychological intervention, such as psychotherapy or some type of other intervention.
What about outside influences on our lives? These environmental factors like the loss of a loved one or the loss of a job, being involved in some sort of trauma, natural disaster, whatever. I mean, how do those affect our psyche? And are those different from the kinds of depression that we're talking about? Or are they triggers to some sort of chemical reaction that creates a sustained condition?
In most cases, they seem to be triggers. The way we think about it is that probably any of us could develop depression if we had a severe enough stress. However, because of biological predisposition, some of us are maybe more likely to develop an episode. And so, in most cases, what we see is that these environmental impacts trigger an episode. Certainly, anyone can have a normal sadness after a loss or in response to some traumatic event, but those should start to improve in a few weeks, and generally the person should be emotionally back to what's normal for them in a month or so. So it seems like those who have some vulnerability, either psychological or biological, often develop an episode after something that's stressful in their lives.
Speaking with Dr. William Marchand, a psychiatrist, a professor of psychiatry and psychology at the University of Utah. His new book is titled Depression and Bipolar Disorder, Your Guide to Recovery. And if you'd like to join us with your questions or comments, 801-355-TALK is our number. Let's go to the phones. Lorraine's been holding in Salt Lake City. Lorraine, hi.
Hello.
Go right ahead.
Do you want me to talk?
Sure. You're on the
air.
Okay.
I just came out of a 12-month, one whole year, of the most severe depression I have ever had in my life. I felt the depression come on me at the middle of February 2011. I finally came out of it at the beginning of March 2012. So the whole of 2011 went by in a blur. Luckily, I have an extraordinary friend who took me in when I got to the stage where I was not cooking, not eating, not sleeping. And he took me in and he fed me and he would get me up in the morning. I would sit on his couch all day. He would then feed me lunch. He would drag me off to the supermarket to go shopping. I would then have dinner and I would go to bed. When he went to bed at about 9:30, 10, I could not sleep without the aid of a pill. I could not get in to see a psychiatrist until the middle of April. And this is one of the problems. From the middle of February to the middle of April, I was unable to find a psychiatrist in Salt Lake City who was taking patients. The other reason was that I had been on a drug called Depakote, which is usually used for seizures for epilepsy. I'd been on that drug for many years. I was stable on that drug, but I'd started developing a severe tremor. My hand would shake when I held a cup of tea, and the newspaper would shake when I held it. It was getting very noticeable. Also, I'd put on a great deal of weight. I'd put on at least 25, 30 pounds. I did not know until later that Depakote, that is one of the side effects of Depakote. Now that I have come out of the depression, I am 35 pounds lighter because I could hardly eat. And also, I am slightly hypomanic, and my family is very, very worried that I will go manic. Now, so far, knowing myself and knowing the symptoms, I have tried not to do that, but I do have the manic energy, and I have stayed up all night on several occasions. But I have had the benefit of an extraordinary education program, the OSHA Lifelong Learning Program at the university. I've also found a personal trainer who has helped me tremendously once I came out of the depression. Now, I want to emphasize that when I was in the deep depression, I could do nothing. I really could not function. And this is what people don't understand. It is not just sadness or feeling blue. It is much more severe than that. Now, I've never been a really violent manic. My son, who is in the emergency medicine field, says that he, as far as he's concerned, mania is far more dangerous because people are a threat to both themselves and others. And my psychiatrist actually said to me when I came out of the depression, "You are now one of my most dangerous patients." And I said, to myself or others, he said, both. You could be driving at high speeds without taking care. You could be making bad decisions. You could become sexually very active. You could spend large amounts of money. Now, I haven't done any of those things. I have had two tickets, one for speeding and one for going too slow. So go figure.
Lorraine, thank you very much for sharing that.
This is a description of depression and hypomania.
No, I appreciate sharing that experience. Yeah, Lorraine brings up a number of relevant points. One is the access to health care. She said she couldn't get into her psychiatrist for a couple of months. Dr. Marchand, are psychiatrists the only ones equipped to deal with severe depression patients?
That's a great question, because access to mental health professionals can be difficult throughout the country. Often people receive treatment from their primary care provider, and that's a very good starting place for many people. There are also advanced practice nurses who prescribe in Utah, and there are many providers of psychosocial treatment, such as psychotherapy, psychologists, social workers, and others. And often they have a good referral network for those that need medication. So it isn't necessary to start with a psychiatrist. I think the most important thing is to be evaluated by some type of medical or mental health professional. And in truth, many people end up not being treated by a psychiatrist just because there aren't enough of us to go around. And in most cases, that works quite well. They often receive medication from a primary care physician and psychotherapy from a psychologist or social worker or other professional.
We're going to get to some of the other points that Lorraine brings up. But before we go to a break, I mean, I just want to emphasize a point that you underscore in your book, is that depression is very debilitating, and it does require a team of people around you, a support group, to get you through it. A good friend like Lorraine's, who cooked her dinner and put her to bed.
Absolutely. And I emphasize that in the book, that having a strong social support system is a key component of recovery for many people.
Speaking with Dr. William Marchand, a board-certified academic psychiatrist and a neuroscientist, his new book is titled Depression and Bipolar Disorder, Your Guide to Recovery. And if you'd like to join us, we're talking about depression and bipolar disorder and other mood disorders. If you've experienced a mood disorder, how long did it take you to seek help? 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. We need to take a break. We'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce. A major study shows that only about half of people with a mood disorder like depression or bipolar disorder ever receive treatment. While getting help can be intimidating, the psychiatrist William Marchand says medications and therapies continue to improve and patients can navigate the mental health system. He outlines just how to do this in a new book, and today on the program we're talking about finding a path to recovery from depression and bipolar disorder. You can join us if you like. If you've got questions about how to find mental health help or what worked for you in treating your depression, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Or send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Dr. William Marchand is an academic psychiatrist, a neuroscientist, a professor of psychiatry at the University of Utah. And his new book is titled Depression and Bipolar Disorder, Your Guide to Recovery. Dr. Marchand, our caller Lorraine brought up other points. One is that there are many medications out there, and there are some downsides to medications as well. And just being aware of what those downsides are is part of the process that a patient needs to go through.
It is. And that's another reason that I wrote the book, because it is often difficult to get that information. I think prescribers generally do a good job of trying to explain the various side effects, but what happens is that there's a lot of information that is exchanged in a visit with a prescriber, and it may be difficult to remember everything. So I think it's essential for patients to have a reference that they can look and see what the potential side effects are.
You know, if depression and bipolar disorder, if a lot of it is caused by the chemicals working in our synapses or whatever, how come we can't just draw some blood? How come there's not a brain scan that can say definitively, okay, this part of your brain is being affected, you have depression, I'm going to give you this drug in this dose? Why? How come we can't be that precise in our treatments?
And we really wish we could.
Of course you do.
That's one of the major limitations of psychiatry as compared to some of the other medical specialties. The why is because the brain is such a complex organ. There are literally billions of neurons, and each has thousands of connections with other neurons. And so the organ is so complicated that there isn't a way yet to look at it from the outside and see exactly what's going on.
So is it kind of trial and error? Try this medication based on our best guess, and if that doesn't work, move on to something else?
I hate to use the word trial and error, but unfortunately, that is the case. For example, with major depression, we know that a variety of antidepressants are effective. However, we don't know for a given person which one will work the best for that person. Also, the potential side effects tend to be individual. Some people have a given side effect with one medication, and another person won't with the same medicine. So it is essential for the person to understand that when they start treatment. And so if they're not getting better, or if they're having problems, then an adjustment needs to be made. Again, a major reason I wrote the book, because sometimes that communication doesn't happen well between prescribers and those with mood disorders. Hmm.
Speaking with Dr. William Marchand, a psychiatrist, author of the book Depression and Bipolar Disorder, Your Guide to Recovery. And if you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number. We've talked about medications. There's such a range, and it's great to have a book like this so that you have it right in front of you when you go to the doctor seeking some help and advice. But treatment is not limited to medication. Of course, you have psychotherapy. You can lay down on a couch. I guess that the couch is actually a myth these days, right?
The couch is a myth. There may be a few people doing psychoanalysis in cities in the U.S. who still use the couch, but for the great majority of patients, we just sit in chairs and talk to each other. The visits are very similar to any other professional.
So what are the advantages of talk therapy, of going in and either in a group setting or a family setting or an individual setting? What are the advantages of psychotherapy?
I think that there are many advantages to psychotherapy. For starters, some people with mild to moderate depression may only need psychotherapy and not even have to deal with the side effects of medication or the potential side effects. But even more importantly, we all have habits and characteristics and behaviors that may not always be in our best interest. And sometimes we don't really notice those. And so one of the things that psychotherapy does is allow us to become more aware of some of those behaviors and make some changes. And so by making those changes, not only does it help us recover from the episode that we're experiencing right now, but it's also been shown to help prevent further episodes. So I strongly recommend psychotherapy for people who use medication, as well as for those who have a milder depression and may not need medication at all.
You mentioned earlier in our conversation about mindfulness as a technique of actually treating depression and bipolar. Explain what mindfulness is. It's this Eastern philosophy of being very aware and sort of living in the moment. How can this be an effective treatment or a strategy in treating depression?
Mindfulness was developed from Eastern thinking, as you mentioned, primarily from Buddhism. And as you say, mindfulness is focusing on the immediate moment rather than thinking about what's happened in the past or what's going to happen in the future. And so several psychotherapy approaches have been developed using mindfulness. One is mindfulness-based stress reduction. The other is mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. And there are some others as well. And so there's a lot of research that shows that these methods are effective for people with mood disorders as well as anxiety. How does it work? Well, what we think happens is that when we're depressed or anxious, we tend to focus a lot of our thinking on ourselves. And it seems like the more that we think about ourselves and what's going on in our lives, the more depressed or anxious we become. What mindfulness does is allow us to distance ourselves from some of that thinking by developing the ability to focus on the here and now. That is, what sensations we're experiencing, the thoughts and feelings that are happening in our mind. And so we sort of observe those from a distance. And by doing that, those thoughts and feelings tend to lose power and have less influence on how we feel. So it's really developing a different relationship to our thoughts and emotions.
Speaking with Dr. William Marchand, he is the author of a new book, Depression and Bipolar Disorder, Your Guide to Recovery. He's a psychiatrist at the University of Utah. Let's go back to the phones. Judine is holding in Sandy. Judine, hi.
Hello.
Hi, good morning. Go right ahead.
Yes, my name is Judine Shelley. I've been enjoying listening to your program. I'd like to tell you that I was a person who was told that I was bipolar about 20 years ago in my life, and I have found that just taking the medication and just going for psychotherapy was not the answer for me, and that it was really important to figure out my own life, figure out what was going on, what was making me feel depressed, and in fact, what was making me feel like I needed to act manic-y or be overly passionate. And I found that there's a lot of things that really have helped, including eating healthy, having good friends, relationships with people who help me feel whole, help me feel like I have a place in the world, getting moving, getting outside, having exercise, and also finding my voice, finding out what's important to me and what to do to have each day be a day worth living for me, rather than a day when I feel like just curling up and staying in bed, which is called depression. It was really important to take my own power, to figure out how to change my life, make my own decisions. And in fact, I couldn't give all those decisions to not a psychiatrist, not a doctor, not a partner. They really had to be my own decisions and my own life. And I had to look at a much broader range than even has been discussed on this program today. And I actually am now a paid employee working in this field of helping people to figure out how to recover and recognize that there's a lot of things that go into each person's life, and they need to figure out what is making them depressed, that it really is related to, as you said early, what's gone on in your life, what's changed, as well as chemical imbalances, which can be part of not exercising and not eating healthy foods. I work now at, our website is powertoyou.org. It's an organization of which there are many in this country and the world that talk about a broad range of what helps us recover from serious mental illness, and that medication alone is not helpful and, in fact, sometimes can even make the symptoms worse or rebound us into different symptoms, you know, cause mania when you've taken a medication for depression and things like that.
Judine, thanks very much for sharing your story, and good luck to you. So she found relief, some help in diet, exercise, good friends. What about some of the more unconventional avenues for treatment, such as acupuncture? Does that work? What about dietary supplements? We hear a lot about that here in Utah. Are these sorts of treatments that have results?
It's difficult to know for sure. Part of the problem is that there isn't always really good studies. For example, acupuncture, there have been some studies that suggest benefit, but there have also been others that have not. And so right now, it's hard to know whether acupuncture is actually helpful for depression. There's evidence that it's helpful for other conditions. The same is true of many supplements. Oftentimes, they just haven't been researched adequately. And so one has to be cautious going down that route. The other issue with some of those approaches is not only do we not know whether they're helpful, we sometimes don't know whether they're harmful or how they might interact with other medications. So the main thing, I think, is when considering those kinds of approaches, it's really critical to talk it over with a healthcare professional and determine whether or not it's something that is appropriate in a person's individual situation.
Judine, thanks for sharing your story. Brooke, who did not want to stay on the line, has a question. What is the effectiveness of ECT? Is this shock therapy? Is that what ECT is?
It is, though I hesitate to use that terminology. People have many misconceptions about ECT or electroconvulsive therapy, many from the famous movie One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Sure.
And it's important to understand that's nothing like how ECT is actually used. General anesthesia and paralysis are used just like any other procedure that involves, or like a surgery. And so the person is not at all conscious of what happens, and they do not have a whole body seizure. ECT is effective, but it's a last line treatment. We only use it or recommend it after all other avenues have failed, and it's something that we would never do without the complete consent of the patient. And so each individual would have to decide for themselves whether or not they want to do it. But it is a very effective treatment for those that have failed all other approaches.
Thanks for that question, Brooke. Our time is short, but Judine brought up another point that just said, you know, at some point she, as a patient, had to take control of her treatment plan. She couldn't rely on someone else to do that. I guess my final question for you, Dr. Marchand, is how can someone who is depressed, whose judgment may be impaired, how can they take control of their situation and find a treatment that works for them?
Well, I would say first that I absolutely agree. Throughout my book, I encourage patients to be empowered and take charge of their treatment. When someone is depressed, they may need some help with that. And that's when family members and close friends can be especially beneficial, and mental health professionals as well. You know, what we do is tell people what the options are and the pros and cons. But it's always up to the individual to decide for themselves what they feel is the most appropriate treatment for their situation.
Dr. William Marchand, a board-certified academic psychiatrist and neuroscientist. He's an associate professor of psychiatry and an adjunct professor of psychology at the University of Utah. And his new book is titled Depression and Bipolar Disorder, Your Guide to Recovery. And Dr. Marchand, thanks so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Coming up next, suicides in the military. But first, a break. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City.